Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very happy to have Jennifer Burns on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. When I was a young man growing up in Kansas, I fell in with a bunch of fellows who were libertarians, at least that's what they called themselves. I thought that this might have something to do with the library, so I studiously avoided the topic. However, they wanted to explain to me exactly what libertarianism was, and I have to confess that what they said was very compelling to my 16-year-old ears. The basic notion was that we should be able to do whatever we wanted so long as we didn't harm anybody, and that when we had something to sell, we should be able to sell it, and when others had things to sell, they should be able to sell it to us, and that authority should get off our backs. This was a very, as I say, compelling philosophy for a teenager such as myself. I didn't really know much about its origins, although I had heard of Ayn Rand, of course, until I read Jennifer's terrific book. She does a great job of explaining the origins of many of these ideas as they were given birth to by Ayn Rand in the 1930s and 40s. Her life is a fascinating one. She is full of contradictions and brilliance and a lot of other things. I guess one of the other things she was full of was amphetamines. She became an amphetamine addict, and that has something to do with her life as well, as you will learn in this interview. Without further ado, here it is. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Doing pretty well.
That's good. You're in California, is that correct?
I am in California, and I have to say, it is not sunny California today, much to my disappointment.
I'm sorry to hear that. You know, I should tell our listeners that we have Jennifer Burns on the show, and we'll be talking about her terrific new book, Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. We'll come back to Ayn Rand's name in a second, won't we, Jennifer? But I can tell you that I lived in California for a number of years. I was a graduate student out there, and I think I'm the only person that left California because I didn't like the weather. It's boring.
Yeah, well, today we're getting a little variety of the kind I don't particularly enjoy.
Yeah,
but
you know,
that's
it doesn't snow in California. Well, it does in the mountains, but
it does snow in the mountains.
Yeah,
for
it
sure.
Snows a lot in the mountains. But I just thought it was this was in the Bay Area, and I just was there's no fall. I don't know, no fall. But enough about that. Let me say by way of introduction that, as everyone knows who listens to this show, I have read this book, and I read this book cover to cover over a series of nights, neglecting my wife and children. And it's terrific in a number of ways, and I don't want to flatter you to high heaven, but it's a remarkably apt topic because of the undercurrent of interest in Rand's life in the United States. And as I say in the introduction to this interview, it even touched me as a young man in Kansas where I grew up. My mother was a big fan of Ayn Rand, and she always had these thick books around. And she said that Ayn Rand was a genius. And this was in the middle of Kansas, of all places. So the influence of Rand, and in the late 70s, early 80s, so the influence of Rand is still with us today. And I was so pleased to be able to read about her life, which is really quite extraordinary. It's not a life I would have wanted to live, but it's really an extraordinary life. And Jennifer, you've done a terrific job of telling the tale. So that was just... by way of congratulations to you. Why don't I ask you?
So
sure,
much.
My pleasure. Why don't I ask you to begin by just telling us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and so on and so forth.
Let's see. I grew up on the East Coast, and I've always been a sort of history buff and a big reader. And so I guess I got into history because it allowed me to read books for a living, which is just fabulous. And I pretty much knew I wanted to be a history professor as soon as I figured out there were such people in the world. I wanted to be a journalist for a long time, and then when I got to college, I sort of realized, oh, wait, I could be a college professor, mm-hmm. and pretty much stuck with that ever since. Mm-hmm. So it's been great. It takes a long time to get there, but for me, it's really been worth it.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to college and you went on to graduate school. How did you come to study... I don't know how to characterize. You know, we have so many disciplines and sub-disciplines in history now. Would you call this a modern intellectual history or political? I don't know what to call it. What would you call it?
You know, I do consider myself an intellectual historian, and that's primarily because that's how I was trained. So my advisor in graduate school, I went to Berkeley, was David Hollinger, who is really a classic intellectual historian, and but very open to non-traditional topics and was very open to doing Ayn Rand as intellectual history. You know, but I started with a pretty strong interest in religion, and the question for me was, do I study religion as social history or as intellectual history? And coming to Berkeley to work with David Hollinger really meant I was going more in the intellectual history direction. And then before I knew it, I was studying an atheist. And so I've sort of moved away from that first interest. But that was really, I sort of backed into this project via my interest in religion. And then I became interested in irreligion and Ayn Rand and sort of went from there.
Mm-hmm. I see. That's an interesting path. What did Hollinger say when you said that you wanted to write Rand's biography? I should tell our listeners that a biography is a very unusual dissertation project. In my day,
yeah,
which is 100,000 years ago, I don't know anybody that wrote a biography just so as a dissertation project. So what did he say, and how did you swing it? I admire you for doing it, by the way.
Well, you know, it was the first idea I had when I came to graduate school, and I checked out like 25 books on Ayn Rand and came to him and said, can I write this paper on Ayn Rand? And he said, absolutely. He got this sort of gleam in his eye. And then I thought, no, wait, I'm not sure. And so I actually, for the next year, pursued more seriously my interest in religious history, primarily in the 19th century. But I still had this thing about Rand in my head, and then the second year I said, okay, now I'm going to give it a go. And then once I started going on the project, it just, boom, went like that. Mm-hmm. I did have a few people warn me. The biography angle was part of it. You know, biography or focusing on one person can be too narrow. And then I did have some people say, you know, Rand is a really difficult topic. She's not taken seriously. People think she's a joke. You know, you might really not get anywhere with this in terms of my career. And it's just so interesting for me as a sort of time stamp. You know, this was 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
That was a reasonable view to have within the academy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in time, so much has changed, and Rand's profile in American culture has become so much more dominant and influential that I don't think anybody would have that reaction today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I timed it really right, but when I started this project, it looked fairly risky,
mm-hmm.
and now it looks like, you know, this great decision that I made. But it was a bit of a risk, and I think the other thing is people always say to me, oh, you did your dissertation at Berkeley. Berkeley is so liberal. It's so left. How could they have handled this topic? And I think that's sort of a vestige of the 1960s Berkeley image that a lot of Americans particularly have. But, you know, Berkeley is a serious, you know, research university doing top class research, and they love being on the cutting edge, and they love the idea of me investigating a really controversial
mm-hmm.
figure about whom not a lot was known, at least by historians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it sort of fit into this iconoclastic tradition within the Berkeley History Department,
mm-hmm.
which is tackling topics that other people haven't.
Mm-hmm.
So I got, you know, a lot of support and a lot of encouragement, not just from David Hollinger, but from a whole range of faculty at Berkeley. So
mm-hmm.
that was really crucial
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
me feeling like it was okay to go ahead and do this topic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, also it's a, you know, I have to say, because I worked in publishing for a while, commercially speaking, it is a dead ringer. I mean, a lot of, you know, and Ayn Rand has terrific name recognition, as they say, in the industry. And so,
yeah.
You know, it's really the kind of book that a commercial or a trade press would love to get their hands on.
Right. And that's not always a good thing within
yeah.
academia, right? So that's been one of the challenges for me, with this book. How do I, you know, draw upon the fact that she does have name recognition without sort of selling out my intellectual soul to writing a potboiler
yeah.
about Ayn Rand, you
yeah.
know?
So it's a tough thing, and I think you negotiated it very, very well. Because the book is very readable, and it is actually a biography. The moments where you digress and talk about objectivism and her philosophical system are from my perspective, thankfully, not too long or too dense. I'm thinking of well, I won't name any names.
No, don't name names.
I won't name any names. But yeah, no, you do a nice light touch of her understanding of objectivism and libertarianism and individualism. So I think that you negotiated it really very well. And I should also tell you that the word is out. This book, I had not heard of it, but a listener to the show in Australia, of all places.
Wow.
Oh, no, not Australia, actually. He's in Israel. Yeah, what am I saying? Yes, he's in Israel. Recommended that I contact you. He had seen the promotional material for the book or found it on Amazon. I don't know where he found it, but he said, you know, you really should do this. It's very interesting. And I said, you know, I really should do that. And so the word is out, and that's really good. So kudos to the people at OUP for, I don't know, spreading the word about this good book.
Yeah, they're doing a terrific job.
Yeah, so the well, one of the things that interested me is that there is no that there was no Rand biography before yours. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think that Rand has been such a polarizing figure that most of the literature about her has been sort of either or. You know, you're either for Rand or you're against her. And it's often come from people who knew Rand personally or were involved with her at some level in their life, so they take this kind of split either way. There have been some, there's some excellent memoirs early in the 1980s that are good source material, but not you know, not a biography per se, more of a biography slash memoir.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that Rand's legacy has been very jealously guarded by those who consider themselves the true inheritors of her thought, and the sort of orthodox objectivist community has been prone to schisms and breaks and internecine warfare and all this kind of thing. And so it's made it, I think, difficult or unsavory for people to sort of get near it. It just looks too too controversial, too personal. And I think I really caught that community at a pivotal moment when those who have controlled Rand's papers and her legacy were actually realizing that protecting it so carefully and guarding it so jealously had actually had the wrong effect of making her less influential and less appreciated, and sort of scaring away anybody who might want to learn more about her.
Mm-hmm.
So at the point when I started my project, her papers had been collected, had been professionally archived and cataloged, and were on the verge of being widely open. And I was only the second scholar to get in there, mm-hmm. and the first to write a full book on it. So my timing was really advantageous in that. And, you know, as a doctoral student, if her archives hadn't been open, this mm-hmm. project would have died immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they were willing to have me come in, give me free rein, and then allow me to publish mm-hmm. What I found, I think really made the difference. And I'm hoping that people realize, despite the legacy of controversy around her estate and her papers, there's a lot more access than you might assume. It pretty much functions as a standard university or private archive. You can go in there, you can go through the boxes, you can see all this stuff. So,
mm-hmm. Where are these papers?
Well, they're privately held. They're held by the Ayn Rand Institute.
I see.
And I think it's in Irvine, California, and it is both an advocacy organization, or Ayn Rand Institute is an advocacy organization. So they're objectivists. They promote Rand's philosophy. You'll see them writing op-eds on TV. They sponsor the Ayn Rand essay contest where, you know, high school students can write essays on the Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged. They give away quite a bit of money for those essays,
mm-hmm.
great prize money. And so that's sort of the legacy, and that's controlled or based upon her last remaining heir, who has the copyright to all her works and owns her private papers. And then embedded within that Ayn Rand Institute is the Ayn Rand Archives.
Mm-hmm.
So they are in a unique position for an archive in that they're both, you know, advocating her ideas and preserving her legacy. So it's not quite as if they were in the Library of Congress, let's say, although there's a small percentage of her papers in the Library of Congress. So I think that's also, you know, been difficult or confusing for people to navigate. It's not as if they're going to a presidential library or a university library where the procedures are really standard and it's really easy to figure out what's going on. But this archive has really professionalized over the course of the 8 years I worked on this project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I'm hopeful that this book will kind of alert people. There is a lot of documentary material here, and it's relevant not just to Rand, but to anyone interested in the worlds that she intersected with, whether it's political conservatism in Hollywood in the 1940s or, you know, American views on architecture, You know, there's a lot there that can be pulled out.
No, I mean, it must have been terrific to go into the archive and be the second person to actually look through the papers. I envy you very much that experience. So let's talk about Rand's life from the beginning, because she comes out of an interesting milieu and one that I know a little bit about because I've studied Russian history. She was born Alisa Zinovievna Rosenbaum, not Ayn Rand. So why don't you pick the story up there? Where was she born and into what kind of family, and how did this shape her later thought?
So she was born in Petrograd in 1905 in Russia, and she came from an affluent background. Although her father was really a self-made man, there's not too much information on his origins. He was able to get a university education in a very limited Jewish quota, went into chemistry, which was, you know, a good safe major or good safe focus for someone of his ethnicity and background at that time, and then emigrated to Petrograd, where he started his business. And then her mother, Anna, was from a more cultured and wealthy background. Her family were tailors, and they had a specialty in doing the uniforms of the Tsar's officers.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they were excellent tailors. So they had connections in high places. They had a good business, and the two of them together, once they were married, had were able to provide a very high standard of living for their children. And mm-hmm. Alisa, there was their eldest daughter, and so that they owned the whole apartment building where the business was and the family lived. It was really an extended kinship network. Many of the families lived together, worked together, went to school together, and it was mostly Rand's mother's family that were all in Petrograd.
Mm-hmm.
So, by her account, Rand framed herself as sort of an individualist from the beginning. She had a difficult relationship with her mother and with her extended family, and sort of felt like, as she described it, as a mature adult, again, this is her reflection and her self-presentation, I felt like I was different from my family, and anything that I really cared about had to be mine and not my family's. And you see that playing out in an early age when she decides, I'm an atheist. By her counting, this was, she was about age 12 when she decided, I don't believe in God. And her family was nominally religious. They did a Seder each year. They did some ritualistic observances, but, mm-hmm. They were much more secularized than the sort of Jews of the Pale. So in terms of how it influenced her, in my book I really focus on this moment when she's 12 years old, when her father's shop is nationalized, her father's chemistry shop is nationalized, and that's sort of the opening scene in the book, because for her that encapsulated so many of the themes that would power her later work. This idea that her father, a producer, a hardworking, moral man, had his property taken, and had his property taken in the name of an ideal of helping other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of started this deep-seated suspicion of, when people talk about helping others, who's paying the price? What's really going on under the surface? And so from then on, Rand would never take anything at face value. She always kind of burrowed under the surface to see what's really happening here. So when people talk about, helping others and being, any of these great moral virtues, she would always look very suspiciously at, okay, if you're helping others, where is the money coming from? Where is the production coming from? Who's actually paying for this?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was a welfare program or the idea of a nationalized state-run economy.
Mm-hmm.
So that really sort of sets her basic impression. And she also described her father, obviously, as being very individualistic, very opposed to the communist regime, and he passed these ideas on to her as well. Now, from that starting point, as I show in the book, there's a lot of different developments and growth in those basic ideas as she figures out how to express them in her fiction and mm-hmm. how they fit in with the other people she's reading and ideas she's gathering.
Mm-hmm. The thing I find very interesting is the fact that she, in precisely this revolutionary milieu among kind of Russian Jewish culture in Petersburg, that she drifted to the right. I won't really call it the right, but she drifted in the direction of Nietzsche, really. Whereas my impression is again, I haven't studied in a long time, but I've talked to people who have, that most of the culturally Jewish residents of St. Petersburg had drifted to the left. A classic example of somebody who's right from this milieu is Trotsky, who was Jewish, and so were actually quite a few of the early Bolsheviks. But was this...
That's the great rap on, you know, communism. It's, you know, very, you know, it's a Jewish ideology or this or that. And so I think in many cases, Rand really does kind of point to, well, things aren't quite what you think they are. And that may, I don't know enough about the circumstances of all of those of revolutionaries you're mentioning, it may have to do with her class position because they had so much to lose and they did lose so much in the revolution. But it is interesting and it sort of marks her uniqueness from the sociological trend of her.
I mean, I should say that I could be completely incorrect about this, that the culturally Jewish revolutionaries that we know about are all quite famous because of years and years of study of the Russian Revolution. And for all I know, it could be the case that most wealthy Russian Jews from St. Petersburg were royalists or at least constitutionalists. I just don't know. And I know who to ask, though. There are people that study these things. Ben Nathans or Johann Petrovsky Stern, I think you cite Ben's book. And Ted Weeks might know as well. I don't know. They're out there. Why don't you call us and tell us?
I think that there is more to be done on exploring Rand's Russian roots and how they sort of fit into her later thought. And, you know, when I meet Russian historians, a lot of them have interesting connections to draw between, you know, traditions in Russian literature and Russian philosophy that she that you can see running through her work. That's not something I dug into in great depth because it's not my area.
Well, then she does something very unusual. They remain there. They get kicked around a little bit by the Bolsheviks, who expropriate most everything. She goes to university.
Right. She goes to, believe it or not, Leningrad State University.
Right.
Which is just kind of amazing when you think of what would you learn at Leningrad State U. I mean, that's another sign of her milieu, how much her family valued education and wanted their daughters to be educated. And again, she kind of snuck in at this moment where she was actually permitted as a woman to go to university, among the first class permitted, and permitted as a Jew to go to the university, two obstacles that would have made it difficult. So that takes her out of this private social world of her family and puts her in the larger world. But she wasn't, very enthusiastic about what she learned in university, and it was a very tumultuous time politically. Curriculum was being remodeled. Things were changing. It seems that one of the major things she took from the university was that you could take any idea, any statement, any piece of history, any work of literature, and sort of burrow down to its hidden political implications, because that was what the Soviet authorities were doing. They were scrutinizing the curricula, the professors, the things they talked about, the things they studied, and saying, this is bourgeois, it's wrong, this is counter-revolutionary, it's wrong, or, oh, this is good, this is communist. So I think that sort of trained her in this methodology of getting under the surface and going down to the root and saying what are the deepest implications of this, and that was something that would give her great insight in certain areas, and then in other areas I think lead her to conclusions that were somewhat far-fetched or not accurate, as you see later in the book when she gets in these huge fights with people because she makes assumptions about where they're coming out. People who would be allied with her politically, but because they're not speaking the same language, she gets very upset at the hidden implications of what she sees they're thought to be. So it's sort of, I think, rather than content, it was the form in terms of how to understand ideas and history and everything is having an ultimate political valence that you could figure out and then make a decision based on that.
I mean, I think that this paranoid conspiratorial style comes right out of the Bolshevik context, because the Bolsheviks were not only conspiratorial in their thinking, they were in fact a conspiracy. So they knew conspiracies very well. And I do think she picks up on that. But I guess one thing that came to my mind while I was reading about her life at this time was how she constructed really the mirror image of Marxism in a kind of epistemological sense, and that is that, you know, the the Bolsheviks and the Marxists at this time felt that you could never escape your class background, that everything you did had been determined by your parentage and your economic position and so on and so forth. And she rejects all of this in objectivism, saying that, in fact, a truly human person would determine themselves. They determine what they want to do by the light of reason. And this is, of course, not what the Bolsheviks or the Marxists said at all. But I did find it interesting that she came to that. I guess... That the influence, I mean, to my mind, the influence of Nietzsche is very strong here. He said most of this.
Well, the other thing I would add is that in terms of her creating an inversion of Marxism, to some degree that was exactly what she wanted to do. And in the early 40s, this was a lot of what I found in the archive that was really interesting to me when she became politically aware in the United States. And she, one of the ways she became politically aware was reading novels that she would send back to her family to translate.
Mm-hmm.
And she would pick through and figure out which novels would be accepted by the Russian authorities, the ones that were leaning left, basically, mm-hmm. the sort of quasi-socialist tales written by, the American left was very strong in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And so she was reading all this literature, and then when she started doing political advocacy, she felt like people are very uneducated about these basic principles and basic ideas, and she basically thought the left has really successfully propagandized Americans into collectivism.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to fight it, what we're going to have to do is propagandize them about individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And so she really, got that idea, and you can see it go into how she finished The Fountainhead and how she thought of The Fountainhead.
Mm-hmm.
She thought of it as an anti-New Deal work.
Mm-hmm.
She thought this book is striking a blow against the New Deal. And I, as an artist and a writer, my role here is to create a new propaganda, a new literature, a new cultural standing on which we can build an individualistic politics as
mm-hmm.
opposed to a collectivist politics. So she really hit on the importance of culture and did what she could to transform the culture so that eventually political or social change could follow. And she always believed that intellectual change came first, started
mm-hmm.
with the fundamentals, and then things would play out. So throughout her career, she would say, it's earlier than you think.
Mm-hmm.
It's earlier than you think. We need to lay this foundation before the changes can actually happen. And after every political candidate that she became interested in, Goldwater was really the last sort of time she allowed herself to hope that a political candidate could do the change, she would ultimately conclude, we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Mm-hmm.
We have to start with the basics. And you see that carry into the libertarian movement and the Libertarian Party in this emphasis on education. A lot of libertarian organizations today are focused on education, on reaching college students,
mm-hmm.
on reaching graduate students, on reaching professors. And this is part of the idea that we need to change the ideas before we can change the policies or the politics.
Mm-hmm. Hey, they got to me in Kansas. I told you about that.
So they did.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
The thing.
I guess I wanted to say as well that we see another parallel here between her intellectual style and that of the Bolsheviks, and you've sort of hinted at it. But this idea that all art is somehow a vehicle for political thought. This is right out of the Bolshevik canon, and they had literally canonized it in the movement of socialist realism, which of course she knew about. So it's interesting to me that she adopted that kind of tact. She wasn't an art for art's sake kind of person. She just didn't buy that at all.
Well, it's interesting because later in her career, it's not so much that art, reflects your politics, but art reflects your sense of existence,
mm-hmm.
And art is a metaphysical estimate of man's existence, she would say. So that led her to be very skeptical about modern art, about realism in literature, anything that sort of emphasized the dark and depraved side of humankind. She would say, well, that's really reflecting a sort of corrupt moral consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And in her view, that's why she was trying to create heroic characters that would inspire and uplift, because this was, reflective of her view of humanity in general. So there is this sort of transition from the political view to later in her career when she's more focused on philosophy to the philosophic
mm-hmm.
Underpinnings.
I found it fascinating that one of her favorite phrases or modes of attack against her critics was she would call people, she would say they have low self-esteem.
Right.
I laughed several times when I read her saying those things, because it
right.
really is
that,
typical of her, you know.
It is, and that is actually probably marks the influence of Nathaniel Brandon, who is a, and I'm sure we'll cover this
yeah,
at some point.
Talk
in
him, yeah.
Really, who Nathaniel Brandon went on to write The Seven Principles of Self-Esteem and sort of become a guru of the self-esteem movement in the 70s and 80s, which is another fascinating RAND connection that I wish I had, you know, another two books to explore. So that's interesting. When she's saying self-esteem, that's the point of her closest engagement with Brandon, and his mm-hmm. conception of the importance of self-esteem is coming out mm-hmm. In those insults. You're right. She mm-hmm. also, bad premises was another,
yeah.
Premises are confused. Would
check
be another.
Your premises. That's what these guys would always say when I was in high school. The, let's get her out of Russia. She, before she leaves Russia, she somehow decides she wants to be a screenwriter, or she wants to be a writer. Is that correct?
Yeah, and again, this is something that's hard to disentangle from the elder Rand's recollections. So a lot of what we know about her childhood comes from some interviews she taped in the 60s, in the early 60s, with Barbara Brandon. And then other bits and pieces have been reconstructed from letters and, you know, in inquiries in Russia. So she frames it as she always knew she wanted to be a writer from the beginning, and she used to make up stories for her sisters, and I think that, you know, the story goes she was on vacation and she saw a poster of some sort about a play or a movie, probably it was a play, and then she realized that she could write stories herself. So she frames her ambition to be an author as having started very young, and according to her, you know, wrote many scenarios which have all been lost. And then, but really the first thing that captured her attention was cinema. You know, when she left college, philosophy was something she was privately interested in, but she really wanted to write for the movies. And I think part of it was just sheer escapism. The watching foreign films helped her survive being in Russia, because it helped her imagine there's another place I can get to. And so that was her ambition. She did sometimes say, oh, I will start with movies and then I'll move on to novels or something else. But she was really focused on screenplays and movies mm-hmm. When she left Russia. And that was, incidentally, how she got out of Russia. It's very unusual that she was able to, one, get out of Russia, and two, get into the United States, given the immigration restrictions that were just coming down. And so her family in the United States owned movie theaters. They were, you know, among the first owners in Chicago. And so what they argued to the Soviet Union was, she studied film in Russia. She's now going to America to learn more about American movies, and then she'll come back and help the Russian movie industry get started.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bought this. Mm-hmm. And she had, you know, she did have this evidence. I'm going to Chicago, where the Lipsky family was part of her, related to the Rosenbaums, they had a theater. Mm-hmm. So that was what enabled her to get out. She knew at the time, everybody knew at the time, that she wasn't coming back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So she goes to Chicago via New York City, and it's at that point that she adopts her new name. Is that correct? I don't remember exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how does she get this strange name?
Well, this, again, is another fertile source of controversy and myth. For a while, there was a story that she named herself after her Remington Rand typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And that had wide currency, and it's since been demonstrated that wasn't possible because the typewriters didn't exist at the time she chose the name. And also, now that the archive has gone through the letters that came from her family. So none of the letters Rand wrote to her family have been saved. Obviously, they were destroyed in Russia, but the ones they sent to her were preserved, and there are thousands of pages of them. And we can see from the letters that she was thinking about Rand in Russia. So mm-hmm. there was references from her family to this name, and she was thinking about the first name, Lil, was one, Lil Rand. So that was one option. And then in
Wait,
terms of where she got...
I was going to say, isn't Lil Rand a rapper? No, wait, that was a joke.
I don't know.
Sorry,
I don't know.
Lil Rand. Go ahead. I'm sorry. So, anyway.
So then she offered sort of differing explanations across her life. She said that Ein was derived from a a Finnish writer whose name she liked and that she just sort of composite made it up. There's also this sort of rumor that Ein was an abbreviation of a diminutive her father used for her, Einiella, and that was something that William F. Buckley repeated as it was fact. And there's some anecdotal evidence that, you know, she spoke to someone in the 60s and said, yes, that, you know, they said, is this where your name came from? And she said, yes. And the diminutive Einiella means, I'm definitely mangling that pronunciation, it means bright eyes or big eyes. Mm-hmm. So the story goes, oh, her father gave her this nickname, and then she mm-hmm. picked it up. But that's very unclear because there's also this idea it's from the Finnish writer. And then she told many different stories. But what was interesting is that in her life in America, aside from her family, nobody knew what her real name was, and she hid it. She really was very worried lest anyone find out her real name. She thought it would have grave repercussions for her family in Russia. Mm-hmm. So people took this as her given name, and she did legally. She was Mrs. Frank O'Connor, mm-hmm. so she'd sign herself Ayn Rand O'Connor. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew it was a name she had really made up. And in fact, early in her career, a lot of people assumed she was a man. And there's these sort of wonderful fan letters to Mr. Rand. And Ayn would reply, I'm not a man, but I'm so glad you think I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
I mean, take it as a compliment.
But there's another Bolshevik connection here, a kind of drawing on Bolshevik culture, and that is that the Bolsheviks all renamed themselves. Again, it's a great example. I mean, they all took pseudonyms and they kept them. They didn't dispense them.
Yeah.
You know, when they
I mean, I tend to put it in a closer context of American movies.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely common to move to Hollywood and change your name. Very common for Jews working in the industry to change their name to make it you know, shorter, more Americanized. And also just in terms of Rand, it really was, she was creating herself anew and she mm-hmm. was naming herself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just has such symbolic import for her as someone who had become an individualistic philosopher. Of course, she had to name herself rather than accept a name that was given to her by somebody
mm-hmm.
else, you know.
Mm-hmm. Self-creation. That's exactly right.
Self-creation.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then she quite extraordinarily just goes to Hollywood and she gets a big break. Right?
She really does.
Yeah.
Gets a big break, meets Cecil B. DeMille. You know, Rand had a way of turning on the charm at the most critical moments. I mean, she did have a great deal of charisma, some negative charisma, as many people have said, but strong doses of positive charisma. And she managed to charm Cecil B. DeMille. She managed to charm her husband. And I think a lot of what that came from was she was very guileless. She wasn't a manipulator. She just didn't understand how to do that. It wasn't part of her makeup. And so she had a sort of freshness and innocence about her that people were drawn to, especially earlier in her life. So she gets the big break, and on the one hand, it's a lucky break. On the other hand, she had kept a film journal in Russia. She ranked over 300 films in great detail, plot, story, actors, construction. So she did know what she was talking about when it came mm-hmm. to movies. I mean, she'd done a very thorough study of movies up to that point. She was not early in this phase of her career successful at getting any of her own scenarios accepted. They were sort of raw and unfinished, but she would make changes to ones that existed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she spent a good deal of time in Hollywood for a while. She had work in the film industry. She went through a period of unemployment that was very difficult. And then as her writing developed, was eventually able to start making a living as a writer, which had always been her goal.
Uh-huh. But how does she do that? I mean, how does she make the transition from writing or doctoring scripts to producing her own material? Her first I don't remember what it was named, but it was something having to do with – it was anti-Soviet something or other, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. She's just writing in her off hours, you know, writing, and she's reading a lot, going to the library, reading as much as she can, trying to, you know, improve her English. And here she really is self-taught.
Uh-huh.
She gets English lessons and has the basic rudiments of English when she gets to the United States. But from then on, it's just slogging through reading in English and getting herself together. And so her first scenario is this sort of melodramatic love story set in Soviet Russia. And it's sold successfully at a time, I guess, that there's sort of a boom for Russian stories in Hollywood at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's bought by a studio, but it's never produced. But that gives her enough money to start focusing more on her own writing. And from there, she works on We the Living, which will be her first novel, and then she comes up with this great play, Night of January 16th, which is still a staple of summer stock because it's a courtroom play, mm-hmm. and then the jury is selected from the audience and then is allowed to actually vote, and then there's two endings for the play. It's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure book. Mm-hmm. Depending on how the jury votes, the play, you know, concludes one way or concludes the other. And so, and Rand wrote it so that it's not obvious, you know, who committed the crime or why. And so her hope was that the philosophical assumptions of the audience would come to the fore in their vote. Mm-hmm. And so this was, you know, one of her first and her most successful early attempt at marrying propaganda and art. Because it was both meant to be an exciting story and sort of reveal the morality or philosophical assumptions of her audience. Mm-hmm. And so she had these, you know, very serious ideals underlining the plot and the story, and it's very heavily tinctured by Nietzsche. And the producer who ultimately bought the play and took it to Broadway, what he saw was, this is a great gag. Audiences are going to love it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they did. And there's a news article, like, I think Helen Keller was one of the jury once, you know, mm-hmm. and so famous people would come and see the play. And so it became very successful. So that was really her big break financially, but she really hated the fact that the play was turned into a sort of popular moneymaker, and a lot of the implications she'd built into the story just were completely ignored or not understood. So, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it was, as she was working on that, she was also working on selling her first novel. And then once Night of January 16th went into production, she had plenty of money, so she was able to just work full time on what would eventually become The Fountainhead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how did she, so she does write a couple of books here. We the Living is one of them. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Anthem, which reminded me a lot of Zamyatin's We, which is a book that I'm sure she knew, because
yes,
it's a dystopian sort of thing. It's cribbed a couple of times, notably by George Orwell, but in the event, she writes these books, and they have some limited success. How does she come up with the idea of The Fountainhead?
Well, as she describes it, there was sort of this moment when she had an acquaintance in Hollywood, who is a sort of ambitious, striving career woman, much like Rand herself, but she really didn't like this woman. And so she asked her, you know, what motivates you, or what's important to you? And this woman responded with basically saying, you know, if anyone has a car, I want two cars. If people have two cars, I want two cars. Basically saying, I want what other people have. I want more than what other people have, and measuring success solely in terms of material goods and relative to the material goods that other people have. So basically, I want more than other people. That's my standard, mm-hmm, of success. And for Rand, this was sort of a revelation. Again, it was so foreign to her psychology to compare herself to other people and to measure herself against other people that she was sort of shocked to discover that many people in this world are, in fact, motivated by what others think of them. And so from there, she pulled out the concept of the second-hander, mm-hmm, which would be somebody who's motivated by the beliefs or thoughts or opinions of others. And then she would contrast that to how she thought people should be, which was individualistic, doing things because they wanted to do them, their own goals, their own desires, and not really caring or noticing what other people thought or felt about them. So that gave her the kind of duality she was looking for. And she's a very binary thinker. It's one of the basic sort of sets of her mind. So now she had the two poles, and from there it was slowly filling in the picture of how these two poles would look in operation. You know, she then discovered architecture would be a good way for her to flesh out these characters. And then over time, it acquired a political valence as she began understanding collectivism as related to second-handedness and individualism, you know, as related to sort of good old-fashioned Americanism or the traditional way of doing things with limited, mm-hmm, government and laissez-faire capitalism. So, mm-hmm, these ideas, which started as sort of psychological or philosophical, acquire over time political meaning as she becomes more attuned to American politics and becomes to identify herself as a Roosevelt opponent. And then it's added to with a great deal of research. She did really painstaking research, and that's one of the book's strengths because left to her own devices, Rand came up with very fanciful and imaginative ideas, and she sometimes needed research to kind of pin her down and solidify her ideas and make them more convincing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that was a revelation to me, I'm not an American historian, but I think that we've largely now forgotten that there was huge opposition to the New Deal, and that she was aware of this. And she was writing to an audience that was sizable and influential.
Absolutely.
And this is, again, something that has been, I believe that idea is buried under the Roosevelt monument in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's also interesting because this opposition to Roosevelt was largely economic in nature. And I think as conservatism over the course of the century became really identified with religion and religious conservatism, this economic piece sort of dropped out. And so one thing I did want to do in the book is recover that history and say, you know, it's not just about the 60s. It didn't start with Richard Nixon. It started a long time ago, and that, you know, the New Deal, it aroused a lot of opposition among some very powerful people. It took them a long time to get their message together and get it heard, but, you know, it was the 30s where a lot of these ideas against, you know, the welfare state and against expanding government were first articulated and first germinated, and then over the course of the century they developed and merged with other trends of thought. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was something I hope to recover as part of this project.
Yeah, you did a nice job of it, because it was it's clear that that at least using my memory as the metric, which is not probably a very good one, I don't really know much about the opposition to the New Deal in the 1930s and 40s. So it was, as I say, a kind of revelation to me that she thought of this as an anti-New Deal book, which is, you know, again, that's quite a remarkable statement to make about a work of fiction. But let's move quickly to the results of her efforts. And The Fountainhead becomes a big hit after she sells it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And this is sort of, in publishing lore, one of the amazing success stories, because it really was sold primarily through word of mouth. And there's sort of the Ayn Rand encounter, or the Ayn Rand phase, really started hitting with The Fountainhead. People, you know, looking to it as sort of a source of inspiration and guidance. And the publisher did not expect it to sell well. And they were astounded every time they had to reissue it. And it kept going, you know, for 5 years, 10 years. And it was given a boost also. Rand at that time was a close friend of Isabel Patterson, who was a very prominent book reviewer. And she didn't review the book, but she would talk about Rand frequently in her columns. So she's kind of putting her name and the book's name in circulation. And then once she got the movie contract, there was wide coverage of the movie contract itself, who would be in the film, you know, and then the film itself came out in 1949. But the novel itself has a sort of staying power beyond anything that was done to promote it, you know, and is still being read and discovered today. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, Rand wrote the story on many different levels. There's this political parable, there's a parable about being true to yourself, a lot of, you know, psychological an exploration of psychology and morality and motivation of the self. And so people can really take a lot of different things from it. And it's, you know, it's a book that I probably enjoy the most out of her, all of that she's written.
I've never read it. I'll be honest with you. I watched my mother carry it around a lot, but I never read it. Those books are too big for me. I can't.
They are.
Yeah,
they require commitment.
They also, interestingly, also they seem to require amphetamines as well to write, because she became a speed freak, didn't she?
She became a regular user of amphetamines, absolutely, and that really sort of kicked in for the final stages of editing the book. And then it was something that she used for the rest of her life. And, I think that this had bad consequences for her. And it's interesting, one of the things that I was able to do in the archive is look at photographs of her, you know, just binders and binders of photographs. And there's it's after The Fountainhead. It's when she's in California producing the movie. There's a couple of years where, maybe it's just a year or a few months, she's loses an enormous amount of weight, and it's just really shocking to suddenly see these pictures of her. I mean, she's bony, she's thin, and she never was a thin woman. So there's that, to me, is okay, she really was using it a lot here. And then at some point, she gains the weight back again. But it was in, so from that evidence, from letters, from what her friends say, this is something she did regularly. She was sort of a low energy person in general, and but very driven. And so she used these medications to kind of drive herself to power her work and her writing. Again, something that was pretty common among writers, you know, Benzedrine had sort of a cult following, and, you know, Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road in 3 weeks with just taking Benzedrine for
And it shows, I have to say, you know. It really shows.
So that's an interesting piece of sort of American literary culture, you know, writing under the influence. And who knows, it's probably still happening today, but it's, you know, probably Ritalin or some prescription drug.
Sure it is, but I mean, I think one thing that can be said is that these drugs, they will make you psychotic, and and especially if they are they are consumed in large quantities. And in her later life, after Atlas Shrugged appears, as people who read the book will find out, she becomes increasingly erratic. She behaves in ways which are not only inconsistent with general mores, but inconsistent with her own philosophy. So she is, as to put it in colloquial terms, she's not thinking straight. And I have to think that that might have something to do with her drug addiction. But
And it really is very damaging to her. I think there are tendencies, you know, in her personality already that this drug really, really exacerbates.
Yeah, no, she becomes extraordinarily extreme and inflexible.
Right. If she was never a moderate to begin with in any sense of the term, but I think that there is a good case to be made that these chemicals just kind of tweaked her further. And you can see she has this close friend in the 40s, Isabel Patterson, and Patterson is like, stop taking it.
Yeah.
And she writes her again and again, you know, I'm going to come out there and spank you if you don't stop taking it. She says, I don't care what the doctor says. And Rand always says, go to the doctor and ask, and the doctor says it's fine.
Yeah.
Well, you know, smoking was also fine back then.
Right.
And so it's too bad. She has some warnings, but, you know, she follows the medical advice, thinks it's fine, and it becomes just becomes part of her lifestyle, really.
And what a lifestyle it was. Let's talk a little bit about – so she writes The Fountainhead, great success, becomes a kind of an intellectual celebrity. Then she writes Atlas Shrugged, which is an even bigger book, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but it also hammers home some of these objectivist theses. But the thing I'd like to hear you talk about a little bit is the formation of what did she call it? The collective, or is that right?
The
collective. Yes, I'd like to hear about the kind of the creation of this coterie of, I want to call them sycophants, but I'm a critical person. Let's call them acolytes. I don't know. What do you want to call them?
I think acolytes is a pretty good term. Students, acolytes, followers. What I think is significant here in the context of the book, particularly, is this group forms. Primarily out of the devotion of a young couple, Barbara Brandon and Nathaniel Brandon, and there's much more to be said about the relationship, but I'll just leave it at that for now. And then they sort of draw in their friends, their associates. Most famously among them is Alan Greenspan, is a member of this early group. And what it really marks is Rand's departure from this broader intellectual and social world of the right, where she was very active and very engaged since pre-Fountainhead, you know, since the late 30s. Into the early 50s, she has a wide range of contacts and networks and is really embedded in this libertarian conservative political world. When the collective forms, that gives her another outlet, and you see her shifting away from these other contacts with, you know, published writers and adults and thinkers of her own age to a group of students or acolytes that are all much younger than her, and she becomes the sort of unquestioned authority on everything to them. And so that's where you see this narrowing of her thought again, because she's not exposed to the influences that helped shape her earlier in her career. And then there's this really feverish energy about her in the inner circle, and that becomes the nucleus of the objectivist movement, which is spread primarily through the Nathaniel Brandon Institute, which is headquartered in New York, but there's these tape transcription courses that people take where they sign up for the course, get a tape recording of Brandon lecturing on Rand's philosophy, and they, you know, meet once a week in somebody's home and listen to these lectures. And so it becomes this intellectual community that's held together by the Nathaniel Brandon Institute and also by her newsletter. Starts as the Objectivist newsletter, then becomes the Objectivist, and the steady stream of nonfiction she's publishing throughout the 1960s. So that really makes Rand into a public intellectual on her own terms. She's rebuffed by the mainstream magazines, the sort of mandarins of high culture and opinion. She says, whatever, I'm going to do it my way, and creates this whole organization. And it should be noted here, this was Brandon's idea. He was sort of the motive power behind it, but it was Rand was the primary draw of this movement and of the classes. And so then she forms her own subculture, really, her own intellectual universe, and this will disintegrate spectacularly in the late 60s, and it then becomes embedded in the libertarian movement, conservative youth culture, and at that point, you know, Rand becomes almost a peripheral figure to the movement and the ideas she's inspired and she started. Mm-hmm. And that was some of the most interesting part of the book to write. I had a strong suspicion that she was very influential in libertarianism, the libertarian movement. And when I started doing the research, I was just astounded mm-hmm. at how influential she was. And it was mm-hmm. almost a research challenge. There's so much material here. How do I pick of just a few things to mm-hmm. show what's happening here? Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, is another part of the story that's not very well known. And that sort of connects this 30s political consciousness I was talking about, this 30s opposition to Roosevelt, takes it right through to the 1970s, the 80s and 90s and beyond, and shows that these ideas are not fringe, they're not marginal, they're a part of American political culture, and they have been for the entire century. Mm-hmm. And so I think Rand is a great lens for showing how these ideas that you don't hear about, you don't learn about, are a palpable presence in our lives and always have been.
Mm-hmm. I think you're entirely right, which is why my mother, the junior high school teacher in the middle of Kansas, was wandering around reading Atlas Shrugged. And
Rand is ubiquitous. She really is, and it's just, heretofore nobody's really sat down and excavated what does it mean that people are carrying around Ayn Rand books everywhere you go.
Yeah,
and so that's really what my book tries to do, is to say here's some of the implications and consequences of her enormous and continued popularity.
Yeah, one of the things I think that I should point out, and you do a nice job of shedding light on this in the book, is that in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when she is enjoying her greatest literary success, this is precisely the time at which conservatism is going off in an entirely different direction and one she doesn't like at all, and that is basically toward, for want of a better word, organized religion, because she's an atheist,
yeah.
She doesn't like this.
And this is – go on.
Go ahead, please.
So I was just going to say, this is why I use the term the American right rather than conservative,
mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't make sense to call Rand a conservative, mm-hmm. because she's not socially conservative, and she is an atheist, a very outspoken atheist,
yeah.
And most conservatism takes religion as a starting point. But with this term, the American right, I mean to draw attention to this secular right that's mm-hmm. limited government, pro-capitalist, doesn't necessarily have anything to do with religion, and that's part of this ideological mix. It's part of that part of the political spectrum, and again, it's been sort of overshadowed by the dominance of religion. And so I also wanted to say, you know, it's not just about conservatism. There's plenty of other people who are on the right who aren't conservative, and a lot of Rand's ideas are very revolutionary. They would, you know, they're radical, and she called herself a radical for capitalism,
mm-hmm.
and that was sort of the banner under which her young followers came to her. Now, whether they stayed radical or they turned conservative, that's another set of issues, and I do follow that in the book, because not everybody stays in the place they start with Rand, but I think that doesn't diminish her significance, because they often take a few key pieces from her and then, you know, move on in other directions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's an interesting moment because, you know, sometimes things break for her and sometimes they break against her. And I think this is one of the instances in which it is the early 60s in which they're sort of breaking against her. And she is a person of principle to some degree, so she will not follow them, and that is the Buckleys and so on and so forth, into what becomes modern American conservatism, this alliance between really sort of Orthodox Christianity of some sort or conservative Christianity and a kind of weak libertarianism. She maintains her own, her kind of, plants her flag and stays there, yeah.
They are very, they're very wary and very leery of her. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, they're scared of her. And you can see Buckley sort of says Ayn Rand is a joke and no one should take her seriously, but he keeps returning to her again and again. And, mm-hmm. and the sort of the warning against Ayn Rand has to be issued regularly mm-hmm. To make sure people aren't drawn to her. And I think he understands how powerful she is, but feels she's so in error that he has to be really careful and make sure that, you know, the youth don't fall to her sway. Mm-hmm. But she's a very palpable threat to conservatism. And what's interesting about this sort of celebration of her work on the right today is the threatening aspects of her work seem to have dropped away entirely. And no one's worried about her atheism or her immorality mm-hmm. in the way they really were worried about that mm-hmm. in the 60s. And then there's a whole sexual piece in her novels that is another thing that conservatives find very alarming mm-hmm. or not something they want to endorse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's interesting in that way. Do you see her influence in modern politics? I'm thinking of the candidacy of Ron Paul or something like that. Where does Rand's thought play into popular American politics today?
Well, Ron Paul is an interesting case. Rand would have disliked him because he does combine his libertarianism with Christianity, and that to her was sort of an untenable, inconsistent position. Mm-hmm. So Ron Paul, admits to a strong like of Rand, but he comes out of a more Christian libertarian context. It's not surprising he's coming out of that Texas worldview, mm-hmm. sort of combining, libertarianism with deep religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. He's not the candidate to sort of draw the line. Mm-hmm. There are just legions of candidates and activists and thinkers and writers in the Republican Party or in libertarian organizations who have come to their views through Rand. Mm-hmm. She's just, as I call her, the sort of gateway drug to the American right. She's mm-hmm. what gets the ball started for many people. Those who continue to academia will usually move on to, more technical work in economics or Milton Friedman or the Austrians. Mm-hmm. And most people are going to combine Rand with others on the same ideological spectrum. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to show how Rand existed with these people and how she came out of the same place, because she's sort of a part of this libertarian stew. And so it's rare to find a hardcore Randian running for office and talking about those beliefs. Just it's really hard to get anywhere in American politics without being religious. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. You see a lot of CEOs out there touting the importance of Rand to them. John Allison of BB&T is one. John Mackey of Whole Foods is another. That's a realm where it's easier for them to just go with Rand's pro-capitalism and not feel like they have to part ways with her on moral questions. Mm-hmm. She's all over the political right today. She's been promoted by everyone from Glenn Beck to Rush Limbaugh. There's this whole trend of going Galt, which is to follow the example of John Galt, the hero of Atlas Shrugged, and restrict your economic production so you're not taxed, suffer punitive taxation. So she's become a real sort of touchstone of the opposition today. Mm-hmm. And it's been very interesting for me to watch, because she's played this role historically. She started with Roosevelt. She was also really important to those who opposed the Great Society and Lyndon Johnson. And so it's not a surprise to me that she's been picked up again by people exercised over both the bailout and then the, early stages of the Obama presidency. Mm-hmm. And what's just interesting to me is how the dangerous or scary parts of her work, or those parts of her work that were dangerous and scary to people in the 1960s, seem really to have been neutralized today. Mm-hmm. Nobody's really worried about what she has to say about her depiction of sex. Nobody's really worried about her irreligiosity. They just see her as a very insightful thinker who provides a warning into how expanded government can be very destructive to the economy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, I'm, I guess I'm very interested in these, my own recollections of people in the 70s talking about her. This is the late 70s, and it was attractive to me at the time, but I think that's because I was 16. I don't know, you know. I mean, really, there is something about it, as I kind of say in the introduction to this interview, that is very appealing to young people in the same way that socialism is. That it seems to make things very simple. Just leave me alone to do what I want. I won't hurt you, and you won't hurt me, and we'll get along fine, and the world will be a better place. I think there's something. Yeah, it has a real appeal to a certain age of person.
You know, that's kind of the rap on Rand, like, oh, you know, teenagers, she's just a writer for teenagers. And I sort of feel like, hey, like, that's actually pretty important.
People
do a lot of reading and a lot of thinking when they're teenagers, and they pick up ideas that continue to shape how they view the world for the rest of their lives. So, I don't think that's an argument against her influence. If anything, it might be the opposite.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, like, Nietzsche is a good example, because I think that he is very appealing to very young people and very old people, neither of whom have really any responsibility. But once you start to get mortgage payments and kids and so on and so forth, it becomes very difficult to try to sustain a kind of Randian life. It can be really, really tough. I mean, I think that it's interesting on a philosophical level to think about what she had to say, and there's a lot of value there. And I'm a pretty conservative person, and I have libertarian tendencies, I'll admit to my audience. But again, now that I'm in the position of someone who has a whole household that I contribute to, I find that my collectivism is showing through. I'm sorry, Ayn.
Well, I think that, you know, that's the beauty of fiction for Rand, is that she can create a universe of her own creation and individuals of her own creation. Yeah. And as, you know, Whittaker Chambers said, in fact, erroneously in his review of Atlas Shrugged, he said there are no children in this book, and there's two children in the book, I believe. There's a brief scene where they appear, but families and children are not big parts of her worldview at all, you know, and Rand consciously chose not to have children. But there's a whole series of questions about family obligations and what you owe other people in your family that her work doesn't really wrestle with. And the depiction of family, especially in Atlas Shrugged, is unremittingly negative. Mm-hmm. And also in The Fountainhead, you know, Peter Keating has this terrible mother who's manipulating him. And in Atlas Shrugged, Hank Reardon's family is sort of just sucking him dry. And, you know, it makes for a good polemic, but I think for a lot of people, that's where individualism ends, when you come up against, just as you're saying, the fact that we are embedded in human relationships, and those do have claims and obligations to us, and it's hard to, you know, keep this sort of idealistic, individualistic stance if you want to, you know, keep your friends and keep your family.
Right, and she didn't want to keep her friends and her family, apparently, because it had disastrous consequences for her personal life. She was estranged from everyone who loved her eventually, except Alan Greenspan. I guess he really
became a distant figure to her later in her life, but it was also very tolerant of her foibles. But principles were more important to her than relationships, and she viewed her friendships as having to be intellectual in nature, not necessarily personal. And it was shocking for many of her acquaintances how quickly, and her closest friends, how quickly she could change from affection to disapproval, and how fast she was to break irrevocably with people. And I think, you know, she often didn't understand where other people were coming from, and put her own darkest interpretations on their actions. And I, you know, one of the sad episodes that I cover is in the final stage, you know, the last decade of her life, when she discovers her long lost sister Nora, and has sends for her from Russia, and is fully ready to, you know, support her sister and settle them in the United States and give them anything they need, is being very generous and very warm and loving. And then her sister arrives, and they start disagreeing about politics, and they can never move beyond it. And what's interesting here is her sister appears to be another version of Rand. Mm-hmm. You know, neither of them will sort of let go, and they spend this entire visit arguing over Russia and communism and America, and eventually, you know, stop speaking to each other, and she leaves, and mm-hmm. it ends terribly. And yeah. it's sad that neither of them could sort of transcend this, and that, you know, that her sister's reaction, you know, indicates maybe there's something in Rand's family or just her basic personality set that was, you know, maybe the Rosenbaums were just very stubborn, kind of principled people and had trouble getting along with each other.
The thing about the parallel of her sister's behavior, I was going to chalk it up to the amphetamines again, but maybe you could pursue that angle. Because, tweakers, they're really paranoid people, and they're very angry, and they see things that aren't there. They really do.
Yeah.
Actually, I interviewed a guy who wrote a book about methamphetamine addiction a few weeks ago, and you know, he describes this kind of behavior, this really sort of extreme bitter paranoia, and a lot of anger, and you know, a real inability to see the world as it is, and a kind of desire to see everything in black and white, and to think that everyone is out to get you. This is really something that I think has a lot to do with amphetamine addiction. But again, you know, I'm not a psychohistorian. I just had interviewed guy about it. You know,
she also wanted to create her world, and you know, a universe in which she could live. So mm-hmm. she deliberately wrote fiction to give herself the kind of world she wanted to be in. And mm-hmm. I think she was perhaps too successful for her own good. It became hard for her to go back. You know, into a world that she hadn't created and she didn't control.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've taken up a huge amount of your time, Jennifer, and I could talk about this stuff all day long, and I imagine that you could too, but you probably have better things to do. I actually don't have better things to do. See, that's the peculiar thing about my life. Close the interview by asking you our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, I have a couple of things underway. I'm doing a little more work on a friend of Rand's, Rose Wilder Lane, who I talk about in the book, who is the daughter of the children's writer Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working on an article on looking at more deeply at her relationship with Rand and with Isabel Patterson, which is something I follow in the book, but I didn't fully explore. And then I'm also beginning to conceptualize a new project. I'm really interested in the intersections between environmental thinking and free market thinking,
mm-hmm.
Something I touch on really briefly in the end of the book, but I think there's some interesting parallels and intersections there, and rather than simply a black and white story of them being, you know, two ideologies that are absolutely opposed to each other, or two tendencies or two traditions of thought,
mm-hmm.
I think there's some overlap and some interconnections that I'm starting to explore, so that's probably where I'll go next, but given that this book took 8 years to write, there may be twists and turns and developments along the way. But
I know how to do it. There's a great graveyard of notional projects. All historians, I have them. I have files of them. Things I was going to
never books got we to. Will write.
Yes, books I will write. Well, anyway,
probably just as long as books I will read.
it's a good point. That's why I do this podcast. See, I have to read the books. I don't have any choice.
Yeah.
I'm on the spot.
Keeps
me literate. Yeah. So anyway, I should tell everyone that we've been talking to Jennifer Burns about her book, Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. And I want to say thank you very much for being on the show, Jennifer.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It was
a
pleasure.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Jennifer Burns, author of Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.